linoleum knife.
Yes, it is.
Linoleum knife.
still learning to say it after three and a half years?
No, I just, my microphone was turned around in a weird way, and it was the twisting it, like I was thinking, oh, I'm going to hit it and bonk it.
And you would never do that.
And I know, I'm trying to, look.
Somebody out there is trying to fill that card, that the square in on their bingo card.
I'm trying to become,
Dave hits the mic.
I'm trying to become better at everything.
Okay.
I have a
every
very,
day in every way.
I have a very few flaws in my life that could use my addressing.
Some fixing?
Yeah. And one of them is that I bonk this mic once, sometimes twice.
Three times a program.
Each episode. And so, if I can minimize these flaws in my daily routine and my professional podcasting life, I can be human perfection.
Uh-huh.
Which is what I'm really close to.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much already.
Uh-huh.
As the boss of this podcast, whose name is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
Uh-huh.
I am Dave White of Movies.com.
Mm-hmm.
Very close to human perfection.
Uh-huh.
Without the... If I can just not bonk the microphone, but if I'm not turning it weirdly while trying to say the name of the show and turn off the music at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Who are you, anyway?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor of The Wrap, which I have been informed now is not The Wrap, and it's not TheWrap.com. It's The Wrap. T-H-E, capital W-R-A-P, one word.
The Wrap.
The Wrap. That's how we roll.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to respond to you the way you just responded to me.
Well, usually when I go on with something that you think when I go with something you think is inane, your attack is to go tell me more
that's what you deserve.
So I'm just well, that's what you deserve on your human perfection thing, because brother, you got a long road to hoe on that one. I'm also on.
It's a row. You hoe a row.
Fine.
You don't hoe a road. Because that would be a crop. You would be planting a crop in a road.
Well,
you hoe the row. You are with a hoe. It's a farming implement.
You are a hoe on the road.
People do the farming in rows with hoes.
You are nowhere in the neighborhood, ballpark, zip code, or district of human perfection. So it's a long road to get to the row.
No. you think quite the opposite, actually, because you've been married to me for so long.
Yeah, but perfection was not what I was shopping for.
But isn't it lucky that you got it almost?
You're ridiculous. You're also...
You know what I learned?
You know what else you are? 50.
Yeah, I turned 50 yesterday.
Dave White is 50 years old.
Yesterday was my birthday.
5-0.
June 7th.
You're 10 years older than Margot Channing.
Yeah. June 7th, 1964, the day I was born. June 7th is also the birthday of Prince, which is great. Also the birthday of other people.
Of my high school friend Matt, who probably doesn't listen to the show, and director Dean DeBlois.
Right. There's a dude we know whose movie we just saw yesterday.
Yes.
We'll talk about it next week.
Mm-hmm.
When it opens.
Yes.
But we can both say and tell you right now that it's great.
Yes.
Sort of an advance.
And we would say that even if you were not our friend.
Yeah. Like when I got in the car yesterday, I said, I wish I didn't know him. Because.
It would sound more legit.
It would sound more legit.
We tell you how great this movie is.
Yeah. But sometimes that happens. Sometimes sometimes you know people who do great things. He just made a great movie.
There you go.
I am
also featured as a film critic on the web program What the Flick.
Oh yeah, that
on the Young Turks Network.
And we're home now.
Yes,
from Atlanta. We were in Atlanta last week.
Thanks again to Kurt Holman for joining us on the show.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Now, here's what I learned when I was fixing to say.
Yes.
What I learned when I was in Atlanta with you is that your family disputes the number of years that you and I have been together.
Yes. They like, don't quite understand
Well, you know what it is? It's the difference. It's the difference between the straight people having, you know.
Are you saying they have white cis hetero privilege?
Basically, yeah. Because, I mean, they, and not just, not your family necessarily, but all
straight people in
general. People in general have a way of marking time with their relationships.
That's about wedding anniversaries.
That is about wedding anniversaries. And it's a thing that is so in the culture that it doesn't matter if you've been together 25 years. When someone asks you how long you've been together, and if you've only been married 21 of those 25 years as a couple, you say, we've been together 21 years.
Right. Those are the anniversaries that get celebrated.
And that's just part of that world. You know, the world of people who get married, that's right. How you say it. But when you and I got together, there was no such thing as gay marriage. There was no such thing as even people thinking that it was ever going to happen.
Right.
And
we did a purely ceremonial one, thinking that that was as close as we were ever going to get.
Yes. And so we have always counted from the get-go.
Yeah.
And there was, unlike a lot of people, there was a very definite marker of time. Because we went from just knowing each other as friends to the next day, like, oh, we're boyfriends now.
Yeah.
Like it was that abrupt.
Demarked.
It was that abrupt of a change.
Right.
Between just our platonic friendship and now, love. And so, the...
He says it like that every time.
Did you like how I just said that? Love. Baby, you know that's how I say it. You know that's how you like it when I say it. Love. Okay, so anyway...
We've known love. Share love.
And so, but... So I'm having dinner with your family, and I don't know how it came up. They're like, it was David.
My brother-in-law.
It was a different, there's another one in the family, yeah. Brother-in-law, David. He's David, I'm Dave. That's how that's how the differentiation happens. Although, now that he has a beard, he's calling himself Dave. Have you heard about that? Have you seen this in action?
Well, he's been Dave on and off.
He grew the beard, and then he was like, we're two Daves. And I'm like, wait a second, when did you, everyone calls you David, you know? You can't have Dave. I'm Dave.
I had called him Dave before you were in the picture.
I see. I always hear him being called David. In any case, he came up, how long you guys been together? And I said 19, and everyone said, no. I was like, wait a second.
Because my siblings did attend our wedding in 97.
Yeah. All your siblings came to our doggy and kitty wedding that we had in 1997, and that's about how legal it was. And that is about how much social sanction it had.
Right.
Probably, actually, less than doggy and kitty weddings, because they put doggy and kitty weddings on the 5 o'clock news as a little bumper at the end, and everyone thinks those are great. And no one was doing those for gay weddings in 1997, I'll tell you. So,
although a local anchor person did attend our wedding.
That is also the case. A local Dallas news anchor did attend our 1997 doggy and kitty wedding. Anyway... So then one of your sisters goes, no, that wedding for us, for the family, she goes, that was real. And that's when you got your papers. So apparently there's this expression that I didn't even really know after all this time of being in your family, that they call it having your papers.
Yeah.
Like when you get married, that's when you get your papers.
Yeah, that's when you get to become part of my family.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's fine. But if it had been, in reality, I didn't get my papers until last year.
Well, 2008.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Here's why I'm disagreeing with you.
Why?
I'm disagreeing with you because we'll get to the movies in a minute. I promise. This is a podcast of the cinema.
Honest. We're getting there.
Seriously, it totally is. Okay, we got cute little California married in 2008.
Right.
But we didn't get federally recognized until 2013.
That's true.
How legit are my papers? Are they 1 year old? Are they 6 years old to 2008? Are they Are they to 2002 or whatever, the domestic partnership papers for California? Or is it 1997, the day we had the doggy and kitty wedding in Dallas that your family all came to and somehow magically believed was real?
They chose to count that
one. That is the one they choose to count.
It was legally recognized in the Republic of Duralde.
October 1st, 1995. Mm-hmm. Our anniversary is October 1st from 1995.
Yes.
And so here's what I have learned. This is the actual lesson I've taken away. Uh-huh. We now have two anniversaries and two timetables that we have to adhere to.
Yes.
We can adhere to our timetable, which is timetable number one and takes priority, in which we are a couple for going on 19 years.
Right.
Or we adhere to July 26th of 1997, which is apparently the official Duralde marker of time. Yes,
apparently so.
Which puts us at almost 17 years.
Correct. But that's...
It's very confusing.
It's that thing...
And I know some of the young Duraldes are listening to this. So y'all explain it all to your folks.
It's the thing about the assumption of a level playing field. It's like when you hear people talk about, like...
Why can't you pull yourself up by your bootstraps?
Exactly. Well, that sort of thing.
Nobody gave me any boots.
It's the assumption of the level playing field. Their idea is, well, sure, you know, we dated and we whatever, but it wasn't really official until we got married. And
I'll tell you when it was really official, when I moved in with you in November of 1996.
I'm saying that
was as legal as that got.
Okay, I'm saying that by their standards, they count their own relationships in terms of that wedding anniversaries.
Yes.
And so they are applying that same standard to us, which in one way is nice that they are treating us thoroughly equal and creating a separate set of standards. But on the other hand, it is, again, the assumption of the level playing field.
Look, I'm down for everything about the Duralde family. The nonstop steaks that were being grilled by your brothers, that was perfect. Because all three of your brothers were like, oh yeah, we're doing the cooking tonight. Like each guy took his turn and each night they were cooking. And I thought, oh good. Because when the brothers do the cooking, that means steaks are being grilled on the barbecue. First night it was lamb. Next two nights it was steak. I have gout now. I ate so much meat.
You do not have gout.
I think I do. I may have in my foot. I have gout in my foot because of all the steak.
No, you do not have gout.
I might have gout.
It's not a tumor. Okay, we should talk about movies now.
I don't know how we got off on that subject.
I haven't.
Well, we went to Atlanta.
Well, yes, and can you turn 50? It's
and
also
I sat at a table with 20 people who told me that my relationship was 2 years younger than I say it is.
Right.
Yeah.
It's also Pride Weekend in L.A. this weekend, so a block from us is...
There are bagpipes going on.
The parade is happening. I just heard a fire truck horn or something.
Bagpipes.
We are not at the parade. We generally don't go to the parade.
I've been to the parade more than you have.
You have, but I tend to skip it. I would just as soon be out of town this weekend every year forever.
That would be fun, yeah.
But so that's happening. So
Let's do that next year.
Yeah, totally. So if you hear more helicopters or whatever than usual over our heads, that's what that's about.
Bagpipes.
And bagpipes.
That was really weird. I've heard motorcycles, but I've never heard bagpipes from the Gay Pride Parade.
Okay, movies. So Edge of Tomorrow is getting
great.
Like very little attention this weekend.
It's such a kick-ass fun movie.
Super fun.
Yeah.
It's based on a Japanese novel, and I really wish they had kept the title.
What's the title?
All You Need Is Kill.
Oh, that was that book.
That was that book.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. That is a great title.
Yeah. The song the Beatles never got around to recording.
Why didn't they call it that?
I think that might have been like a working title, and maybe it didn't test well.
Why would that not test well?
Yeah, because Edge of Tomorrow doesn't really tell you anything.
It sounds like an old soap opera.
It does. It's like a combination. It's a mashup of Edge of Night and Search for Tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, All You Need Is Kill. Rated PG-13.
That would sell me.
I would go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so it is a...
We named a movie podcast Linoleum.
Yeah, true. What do we know?
Yeah.
So it's a sci-fi story. It does have a few things in common with Tom Cruise's last big movie, Oblivion, but not that much. And
I guess
he plays a sort of oily PR guy for the army. You know, it's the usual Tom Cruise. You know, like goes from jerk to awesome guy. But he starts out as basically trying to talk people into joining the army to fight this alien invasion that has been happening throughout Europe. And there's been this one super soldier who decked out with this kind of, you know, exoskeleton tank thing, managed to lay waste to a whole bunch of aliens, and that woman is played by Emily Blunt. So then Tom Cruise is told by the general of the forces in Europe, played by Brendan Gleeson, that he's going to be embedded in a unit with troops during one of the basically like the big Normandy invasion of this movie. Tom Cruise is not having it, and then finds himself knocked out, wakes up busted to private at Heathrow, and he's being shipped out with just the grunts into this thing. And the battle is a disaster. The aliens just have them cornered at every turn. And something happens to Tom Cruise, and the moment that he dies, he wakes up again at Heathrow. And it all starts over again, and he knows what's going to happen, and he knows what people are going to do. And slowly but surely, he manages to get it together enough to get into contact with Emily Blunt, who seems to be the one person who understands what he's going through, and on from there. This movie's directed by Doug Liman. He did the first Bourne movie. He did Go and Swingers. And this is a lot of fun. And it's got a real energy to it. It gets the time travel stuff right. And, you know, it's kind of Groundhog Day-ish. And it's kind of Starship Troopers-ish. And there's a lot of movies, a lot of things in it from movies you'll recognize. But, you know, I'm fine with people ripping off other movies as long as they do something with it. And here they do. You got Christopher McQuarrie wrote the screenplay with the Butterworth brothers, I think they are.
Yeah.
I had a great time.
They're the sons of Mrs. Butterworth.
They did not go into the food service industry like their parents. What did Mr. Butterworth do?
They're thick and rich.
Well, they're rich. Sure. They wrote this thing.
What I love the most about this movie, other than just the fact that it's just sort of like hammering you the whole time, there's these great blunt editing cuts, you know, where he's just like, boom, killed, boom, killed, boom, killed. It's a joy to watch him get killed over and over and over again. Like,
and having to basically start the video game over from square one, where he has to know exactly when to duck and all that stuff. And the movie implies a couple times like what he has to go through to get to the next big point. And then after a while, they can skip that part because they know you know that he has to do that every single time he gets regenerated.
And even though he inches his way toward progress, there are sequences about halfway through where you think, is this really going to just going to end like this? Like, is he going to make it? Like, is this the movie where Tom Cruise just dies?
Like, at one point, Emily Blunt asks him about, well, what about blah, blah, blah? And he goes, I don't know. This is the first time I've made it this far.
And so there's a sort of black humor to it. This very dark, you know, playfulness with the idea of futility. And I really love so much.
There are times that he basically gets killed by somebody on his own side just because he breaks his leg or something. Right. And clearly the training's not going to go any better. Like, all right, we just got to start this over.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, they just hammer him and hammer him and hammer him. I call him Mecha Sisyphus in my review at movies.com.
Clever.
And I like the teasing of, you know, of the idea that will this be the film where he is finally just destroyed? And the other thing I like is it's very well made. It's really funny and it's really fast. And the action is good and you can understand it. The aliens are weird. They're like these tumbleweeds that are made of razor wire, but they also are sort of have tentacle-ish qualities, so they can just reach out and grab you too. Right. They're ugly, disturbing
and
aliens.
A big weird mouth.
They don't have faces. You know, it's just this nasty little things. And I also like the idea that this is the Tom Cruise story.
How so?
That that the world now is a little hostile to him.
Like, that's the thing.
He has not fared well in the past, I'd say, 10 years. You know, his films have done okay to very well, like War of the Worlds, that
right.
where everyone said, oh, your career's over after War of the Worlds. Well, War of the Worlds made an S ton of money.
And well, this is,
and was a huge hit.
And this is being a hit everywhere but here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what is interesting to me is that because of the public, the as I called it, the collective public side eye that we are now all giving Tom Cruise, he knows it's happening. Like, he's so fully aware that it's happening that he's got this look on his face now, this hard sort of, oh, I'm going to win. You don't love me? I'm going to make you
and
love
you,
me.
And you, and you,
and you. And you can see, not in this film, obviously, as a character, each time he gets killed and brought back to life, his face gets a little harder, like, all right, I'm going to do it.
This is going to be the one.
I'm going to do it. This is going to be the one. And I feel like that's how he's approaching his films now in real life. Like
this time.
Yeah? Oh yeah.
You didn't like Jack Reacher, but
this
one.
You think you got me? I'll show you. I am detailed and I am professional and I will win and I will be a movie star again. I will.
I think it's even more recent though, because I remember telling people, oh my gosh, you have to see Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
And they were all so good.
And they were all like, oh yeah, great, that sounds fun. And this one, boy, it's like, hey, dude, Tom Cruise, oh, haven't we seen this movie already?
Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol is terrific. Jack Reacher is weird.
It's fun and odd.
And yeah, and a lot of fun.
Weirdly funny at times.
Yeah.
While violent.
And he gets to play a total weirdo in it.
Yes.
And there's a sequel happening.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I'm so excited about.
What's the line the guy says? Like, weird meeting you or something?
Weird to meet you.
Weird to meet you.
Yeah. Like Don Cheadle says it to him.
Yeah.
Is Don Cheadle in Jack Reacher?
No, it's David Oyelowo.
Oh, it's David Oyelowo.
Oyelowo.
Oyelowo. Sorry, I thought it was... My memory says Don Cheadle.
No.
I just insert Don Cheadle into things.
In everything, yeah.
So,
You think he's Helena Bonham Carter, you know?
Yes. I really dug him in Sweeney Todd. Room with a View. When Don Cheadle's in Room with a View.
Oh, that's the best.
And falls in love with Julian Sands.
One of those big picture hats.
Maggie Smith is looking all scolding at him. Stop misbehaving, Don Cheadle. I dug Tom Cruise in that crappy Rock of Ages.
He was the one person who sort of knew what he was doing.
He's a freak in Rock of Ages. But you can feel him being happy being a freak mm-hmm. in Rock of Ages. So, I'm not saying that I'm, you know...
Totally on board.
Rah-rah Tom Cruise now. I think he's a weirdo in real life. But I'm willing to be okay with that. And as long as he keeps doing movies that are fun to watch... I'm all right with him.
I will say this.
There was a moment in the early Mission Impossibles where I got on the syndicated radio show that I was doing, and I said, I can't stand this dude. He's a giant box of nothing. And I got so much hell from the hosts of that radio show and from their listeners that I was like, you know what? You're all wrong and I'm right. I don't care how much flack I get for this. But I've changed my tune. I'm back to being on the Tom Cruise train again.
I will say that he is relatively playing it safe. I mean, yes, Jack Reacher is an eccentric choice, and this is not necessarily, you know, this is a movie that makes you work for it a little, and it's not the most obvious kind of action movie. But this is not the Tom Cruise who worked with Oliver Stone and... Martin Scorsese and Paul Thomas Anderson, and took, you know, 2 years off to work with Kubrick, you know.
He'll get back there.
Yeah, I'm just saying, at the moment, we're in a phase where he's more looking at the bottom line, realizing, okay, I'm over 50, I gotta, like, keep a grip on
this
thing.
I gotta make
them
be into me again.
Yeah.
And I think that's fine, and eventually he'll start, you know, going back to working with
Amy Nicholson, you know, she had a really interesting piece in about him in general in the LA Weekly a couple weeks ago. And then this week in the Weekly, she reviews...
Well, her book about him either just came out or is about to come out.
Amy Nicholson wrote a book about Tom Cruise?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I think for Cahiers du Cinéma.
Oh, wow.
I think so.
Okay.
I think that's what put it out.
Well, in her review of Edge of Tomorrow that's in LA Weekly this week, she talks about how he's kind of been apologizing for Top Gun ever since making it in terms of making movies that portray war in an unflattering light. And she references, you know, Born on the 4th of July, Lions for Lambs. And this is definitely one of them. This is, you know, soldiers are lambs to the slaughter in this movie over and over again. It's not like Top Gun where people are going to run out and join the Navy. And Emily Blunt is a lot of fun in this. Her casting makes perfect sense once you realize the events that have brought her to where she has become. You know, so like you would think, oh, well, she's supposed to be this badass super soldier. Why didn't they cast, you know, Michelle Rodriguez or, you know, Zoe Bell or somebody? But given once the plot unfolds, you go, okay, Emily Blunt, that makes sense.
in the context of what has happened to her character,
yeah,
you need a
non-obvious
female role. You need a non-obvious female lead because she didn't go into this situation a Zoe Bell level badass.
Right.
She's Emily Blunt.
Yeah. So she went in, you know, one stomach flew away from her goal weight.
She went in being the Emily Blunt, you know, and they turned her into a killing machine, which is the point of the film.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of genius casting.
Go see this movie, you guys. It's really fun. And as somebody pointed out,
you want a very cool summer action movie?
This is
absolutely hit.
And I forget who tweeted it, but I think somebody at HitFix, Daniel Feinberg at HitFix tweeted, he goes, this is the kind of movie where action fans are going to watch it on a Blu-ray or on an airplane and wish they had seen it on the big screen.
Yes.
So go see it on the big screen,
yeah,
is what we're saying. Dave, from whom is this show brought? By whom?
To what? Won't you? Is it? Me don't know.
By whom to you is this show brought?
Focalpress.com.
Mm-hmm.
Focal, F-O-C-A-L.
Yes.
Like a focus, but it's your focal.
Focal point.
Mm-hmm. Focal point, yeah. Focalpress.com. They put out how to make movies books.
Yeah.
Do you want to make a movie? Have you not written your 25 words or less essay for the real truth yet?
50 you gave them.
Did I say 50?
You said 50.
Okay, good. You got 50. We'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that.
Talk about that in a bit. But here are a bunch of other books on how to make a movie. And these are very specific books. These aren't, like, the real truth is all, like, here's everything in one book. But Focal Press, like the books we've talked about so far,
they get specific.
The Shut Up and Shoot Documentary Guide.
Mm-hmm.
How to, if you want to make a documentary. The TV Runners. The TV Showrunners Roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
You want to run a TV show? A hit one. Hit TV show.
That's right.
Not these little piddly sort of hanging on by a thread TV shows.
No.
Hit TV
hit.
Show. Yeah. Write to TV.
Mm-hmm.
How to write a TV show. And this one, the last one that we're going to talk about, is called Digital Cinematography.
Whoa-ho.
Fundamentals, tools, techniques, and workflows. I don't know what a workflow is, so I'm just going to pretend
that I know what a workflow is. Given that you love lists, I think you'd be down for a workflow.
What does it mean?
I think workflow has to do with like scheduling and stuff, I think.
I don't know.
It's too bad David Kittredge is not here.
I know, we just made him waffles, and I tell you, if there's anyone that this book is for,
he knows a camera.
Him, yeah. It's by a writer named David Stump. Here's what they tell me about this.
Okay.
David, whoa, and I just scrolled back up to my thing. Look, I'm, again, nearing human perfection.
Yeah.
Almost there. David Stump's digital cinematography focuses primarily on the tools and technology of the trade, looking at how digital cameras work, the ramifications of choosing one camera over another, and how those choices help creative cinematographers tell a story. This book empowers you.
Woo! Right on, woman.
It empowers you.
You're giving me a fist in the face.
It empowers you.
Am I fist bumping?
I just want you to go, woo, again.
Oh,
woo. It empowers you.
Woo!
Yeah. To both correctly choose the right camera and workflow for your project from today's incredibly varied options, as well as understanding the ins and outs of implementing those options. Stump, that's a great last name, sheds a light on the confusing advantages and disadvantages of shooting theatrical features using digital technology and what it can and cannot do.
Here's a tip.
And I mean it when I say Stump is a really great last name. No. This is sort of like, your friends would not call you David because that's his first name. Your friends would just be like, Stump. Yo, Stump.
Yeah, no.
It's
cool, punchy.
That's a cool name.
Here's a tip for budding cinematographers. Don't be like Tommy Wiseau in The Room and shoot your entire feature simultaneously in digital and 35.
It would have been great if we had kept our friend Dave Kittredge around.
Yes.
If I had known we were going to talk about this, because there is no one, there is not a bigger camera nerd that I know than that dude.
Yes. Like, now, there aren't bigger ones out there, but in our circle.
You cannot be in his company, and I know he listens to this podcast because he told us he did. You cannot be in his company for more than about 8 minutes before there's a discussion of something related to digital cameras.
He did not bring it up once during Waffles.
Didn't he?
Nope.
Are you sure?
I'm sure.
Well, that was weird.
We did talk about the theatrical cut versus director's cut of Alien, but that's it.
I remember standing in line with you guys for a movie one day, and you guys started talking about aspect ratios and digital versus film and just a host of techie little topics. And I stood next to you in line and I thought, I wish I had a book. Because then I wouldn't have to listen to you guys talk. And also, I could pretend I don't know you.
Well, if you had a copy of this book, you could learn more about...
Because if I stood next to you in line reading this book, you would just engage me. You'd be like, hey man, what you reading? Ooh, digital cinematography. Let's talk.
I don't even know that much. I'm sure Kittredge was carrying the water on that conversation. Aspect ratios, maybe. You know, like if you listen to our White Christmas commentary, I do discuss what VistaVision is. But you know,
yes, you did.
It's not really my.
It was the slowest point of that.
Well, you know, and episode. You'll note that I saved it. Yeah. Like I could have brought it up right when the word appears on the screen at the very beginning, and I knew that people would tune out.
So what I'm telling you is, if you need to know about digital cinematography, if you're making a movie, go read this book, Digital Cinematography, Fundamentals, Tools, Techniques, Ricky Mastukes. Digital Cinematography, Fundamentals, Tools, Techniques, and Workflows by David Stump.
Mm-hmm.
And make friends with our friend David Kittredge, and he will tell you a whole lot of stuff, too.
Buy him lunch.
He's good at knowing things.
It's true.
He made a film.
He did.
He made a film a few years ago called Pornography, and it is not...
Pornography.
It is not pornography. It is a film called Pornography.
Pornography colon a thriller,
I believe. He made it.
And it's on Netflix streaming.
It's on Netflix streaming.
We will provide a link to Mr. Stump's book on our Facebook page and on our Twitter feed.
To focalpress.com. Yeah.
We could do that too, sure. Anyway, thank you to Focal Press for your support of the program. Moving on, the big release of the weekend is The Fault in Our Farts.
It is not terrible.
Fault in Our Stars.
I'm gonna tell them what it's about.
Don't make me go first. You always make me go first so that you get the last word.
I'm just gonna tell you what it's about. It's my turn to discuss the plot. Hazel Grace Lancaster is a 17-year-old girl with cancer. Augustus Waters is an 18-year-old boy whose cancer is in remission, after it has already cancered off part of one of his legs. They meet in a support group for cancer teens, and they start hanging out, and he's immediately smitten with her, and he is laying it on thick all the time. She, by contrast, is not having it. She does not want him to be in love with her, because she thinks she's fixing to die like any minute, first of all. And also because I don't think she trusts him, because he's too good to be true. He's tall. He's that kind of good looking that young teen girls are really into, the kind where you look like kind of like half a girl yourself. You know, you're a guy, but you've still got that very sort of like boy band softness to
you. And you're just blank enough that girls can project anything they want onto your face.
And so, but he's got all the right moves. He smirks really perfectly. And he has a novelistic way of speaking, which I obviously this was, you know, dialogue lifted directly from this YA novel.
Very popular, very best-selling novel.
YA novel. And he has all the right words. He's loquacious and wise beyond his years. He knows about love and loss and life and
even though he's a virgin.
Everything, but he's a virgin. He's perfect. He's perfect. He's perfect boy. Obviously he finally gets what he wants. And she does too. And then something weird happens, but well, I should say the weird thing happens before they decide that they're in love. Because they go off to Amsterdam. Not because they're in love, but because she makes him read her favorite book about cancer. And it's written by, it's not a real book, it's written by a fake author.
An Imperial Affliction by Peter Van Houten, yeah. Which I only remember because both title and author are mentioned about 20,000 times over the course of this film.
The book ends ambiguously.
In the middle of a sentence.
And this bothers both of them.
Because, well, mainly her.
Because that no, he too is annoyed by this.
Oh, that's true.
When she makes him read it, he's like, "I can't believe it ends this way." Mm. When you are young, you demand that kind of resolution. You're not super into ambiguity. That's right. An adult trait. That if you can deal with ambiguity,
right. You need to know that Babs winds up working it as a Universal tour guide.
A mark of maturity, and so they don't have that yet. Yeah. So they travel to Amsterdam. To get the answer, what really happened after the book was over, to the characters. And the author is played by Willem Dafoe in...
Looking like David Mamet.
Looking really...
Like a drunky David Mamet.
Wrung out and haggard and beaten down. And he's mean and he's dismissive and he's sarcastic. And he tells them that the cancer's eating their brains, which is hilarious. And that
the world is coddling them out the of world pity.
And this is the most interesting part of the film, that where he says to them, and I don't really consider this a spoiler, because the only real spoilery thing that I could tell you is what happens at the end. Right. I am not going to tell you what happens at the end. When the DVD comes out, we will revisit this film and discuss it in
We always say we're going to do this. Well, and maybe we never do.
We have every intention.
We still owe them a loop back on Cabin in the Woods and something else. I forget what.
All right. Well, maybe we won't. Anyway.
Maybe we'll do a special episode that's like for subscribers only that's all spoilers.
That would be kind of funny. maybe we'll do that. Okay, so he says to them the most interesting thing in the film. Your illness has pushed you into a social system that infantilizes you. It is a social system that it's constructed to pity you and to keep you, a child. And he won't indulge that. And they're mad at him. And then they go back and they egg a car.
Well, not immediately. They don't egg his car.
It's a function of their rejection of him. Mm-hmm. That they go back and they take it out on someone who has refused, who has also refused to cooperate in the sympathy aspect of being a child with cancer.
A terminal teen.
Yeah. So, anyway, you tell people what you think of this, and then I will give my moderate defense of it.
I will say off the bat that Shailene Woodley is terrific as Hazel, and that Laura Dern is really good as her mother.
They really are. They really are. Both of them are terrific.
Those performances are dynamite, and I take nothing away from them. They really are effective. The material... I find just unbearably sort of hokey, and for a movie that starts out, and apparently the book does this too, basically starts out by telling you this isn't going to be another one of those sappy, uplifting cancer movies, as though it were like too smart for its own good. It's a sappy, uplifting cancer movie.
Kind of, yeah.
And it is a sappy, uplifting cancer movie that relies almost exclusively on making us love its male protagonist as much as its female protagonist does.
Right.
The male protagonist is played by one Ansel Elgort, who was last seen playing Shailene Woodley's brother in Divergent,
yep.
and also appeared in the Carrie remake as Tommy Ross. I found him unbearable for the entire run of this film. I wanted to punch him in his cancer remission face. He's so smug and self-satisfied and self-adoring and such a construct of baloney. I didn't buy him. I didn't like him. I thought she could do better because she's such an interesting character.
Yeah, I
found him just irritating. It was like that thing where suddenly the theater has released the ants, you know, and they're all over your skin. Every time he was on screen, he just got on my nerves.
So it was the tingler.
It was the tingler. And that's why I was screaming throughout. So yeah, he single-handedly torpedoed this whole movie because the whole movie is supposed to be about like what a teen dream he is and how he comes in and makes her life so awesome and opens her eyes to blah 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 blah. Hated him.
Not that much blah blah blah, just a little blah.
Okay,
blah,
whatever.
Yeah.
He drove me up the wall. I would much rather have seen the movie with Nat Wolff, who plays their friend who loses his eyesight to cancer. In that role, I would have bought it more because that guy I find kind of charming, even when he's playing a horrible date rapist like in Palo Alto.
Yeah.
But yeah, this Ansel Elgort guy, he made not much impression on me in either Carrie or Divergent, but I actively loathed him in this movie. And so it didn't work for me.
All right. I don't hate this movie.
Okay.
I maybe should hate it, but I don't. The reason I don't hate it is because this movie is a teenager.
I know what you mean, but explain it to, yeah.
Okay. And that's not an insult, really, to me, because I was a teenager.
Sure.
And I remember. And when you are a teenager, everything is stupid, and everyone is a jerk.
And embarrassing.
And embarrassing. And so, you need films like this to, you know, affirm your view of life. You need to wallow in misery. And you need to sob it out. Just because you need it. You need that. And this film and this book, written by adults in the voice of teenagers, but with adult wisdom, is sort of an aspirational kind of thing, you know. You want to be as smart and with it as he is. You want to be as wise and collected and brave as she is. Because she really is. Her character is facing death head on. And sort of, and not having it. Like, yeah, I'm going to die, and that's all there is to it. And you're not going to lift me off my feet. You're not going to sweep me off my feet, boy, until he does.
Right.
And you phony adults, you grew up and your heart died, like Ally Sheedy says.
Yes.
you know, you all suck, too. And so films like this, they exist for this reason. They are for a young audience. They are not as wise as they think they are because they haven't, you know, their protagonists have not experienced enough yet, and the adults writing it aren't letting them, and they are tailoring this story to that audience. So, yes, it's kind of a pack of lies in a way, but it's satisfying and it provides a kind of emotional catharsis that isn't sophisticated, but it's effective.
But see, here's the thing. I love a good teen movie. You know,
I know you do.
And this movie, I felt so pandered to that notion of when teenagers realize that they're going to die. And so then they romanticize this whole notion about, you know, either killing themselves or meeting an early end. And, right. you know, I mean, there's a scene in this movie where someone attends their own funeral, which is yes. like such a teenage wank,
right.
you know. And, yeah. And I mean, there is something weirdly aspirational, the fact that these characters know that their time is numbered, that their yep. days are numbered, that their time is up. And so since all teenagers think deep down that they're going to die because they're the center of their own universe, and then everyone will be sorry, blah, blah, blah. That's this whole other level why they've hooked into this story so much.
Yeah.
And I just found it just to be such bunk, you know? And the thing is, a good teen movie can be this immature and still sort of sweep me up in its teenness and make me see it, the world through those eyes and be like, yeah, man, you don't understand. And this did not do it. I mean, again... Let's look at We Are the Best.
Right.
That's a movie about teen concerns and about even teen brattiness or whatever else. Yeah. But it's still the adult eye on that film is observational and amused, but it's never pandering.
Correct.
This movie panders with every fiber of its being and down to the wall to wall. Now, that's what I call emo soundtrack of this movie. Like, not a moment can pass without some, like, la, la, telling you how to feel about every moment.
Right.
Even, like, there's a big letter reading at the end of the film that you can almost not even hear it because there's some, like...
Yes. Ugh. When... As much as I love the John Hughes movies,
mm-hmm.
they did a lot of that, too.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, when Ducky is sitting in his room alone
mm-hmm.
and the Smiths are playing, that was very powerful,
mm-hmm.
you know, to its audience at the time. When we were young, that was what we responded to.
Sure.
And so...
But you can look at it as an adult and realize this is a portrait of teenage self-indulgence. And teenagers can look at it and go like, yeah, I've been there.
And I know that you are saying that this film is that indulgence.
Yes.
And instead of being a portrait of indulgence, mm-hmm. it is indulgence itself.
Yes.
And I agree with you. It is.
Down to the title we even talked about.
But I know. Because the title is taken from Julius Caesar.
Correct.
Yeah, it is...
Hang on, I'll dig it up.
It is not The Fault in Our Stars. It is us.
Yeah.
It's us.
Yeah.
But this...
This movie should just be called Not My Fault.
Exactly. It is The Fault of the Stars. I've done nothing wrong. I don't mind this. I don't mind that it is a shameless wallow.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mind... It's kind of like the teenage version of P.S. I Love You. I don't know if anyone saw that. But that's the same thing. I remember writing about that movie and saying, like, basically, if you have smuggled in to the theater in your purse an entire box of Sara Lee chocolate-covered cheesecake bites, and it's a Monday morning and you're in your sweats and you feel bad. You're like, you took the day off from work and you just feel like crap and everything's awful and you just want to go see a movie where you can cry and it's not even a good movie. You just don't even care anymore. That's basically what this is. I'll tell you, the sobbing that went on in the press screening.
No. We didn't go to the press screening.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. We didn't go to the press.
Yeah. We paid and saw it opening night with the hardcores.
What am I saying? Yeah, we saw it Thursday night with the kids.
With the big super fans.
We were not only the oldest people in the screening, we were the penisest people in the screening.
We were the Y chromosomist people in the screening.
There was so much audible crying going on in the theater that I just, at one point, I looked around like and thought to myself, wow, this really happens. Like, this really goes down.
I was having flashbacks to the press screening of Les Miserables, where I was surrounded by people like...
Were people crying in that
Oh,
too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I was just like...
Because I watched the screener DVD.
And I was just...
I didn't go to the actual press screener. I watched it on the promo screener that we got. I think that, you know, if you're 14...
But I'll tell you, a lot of these people I noticed would start crying at the beginning of scenes because they knew what was coming.
Well, yeah, because the kids have all read the book.
Yeah, and so I was we were having a conversation afterwards that, you know, you have the book, and then you have the audio book, which is somebody just reading the text, you know, as is. And I think there are certain movies that we should just start calling the video book.
Well, yeah.
Because they just exist to sort of make the fans of the book relive it all again, exactly as closely possible to whatever. And no matter how crazily indulgent the book might have been, which I haven't read this one, but based on the movie, I'm assuming it's the same kind of sop for teens.
Cinematically, it's not interesting. It's not ambitious.
No.
At all. It's forgettable. But
except when Hazel and her oxygen tank have to climb all those stairs to get to the Anne Frank attic.
That is really harrowing, yeah. Genuinely so.
Yeah.
But as an emotional sort of, you know, the flashpoint sort of thing, like a totem, something for kids to go to. This is not a film for grown-ups. It's a film for young teenagers.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it. I think it's effective at what it wants to do, and if you are gonna crap on it for being that thing, I think you're missing the point.
Well, do they think that kids would not respond to it if they made their cancer kids look like cancer kids, because they're pretty hale for people with terminal illnesses?
Well, Shailene Woodley does a good job of looking sickly, I would say.
She's maybe a little wan at times, but for the most weak, part...
She has weird hair. But, she's got the tubes up her nose all the time.
Yeah, the tubes, yeah. Like, she's like John Travolta in Battlefield Earth.
That is a really good choice. I'm glad they did that to her.
But beyond that, though, they still look pretty, like, magazine cover ready.
And I'm going to just reiterate how good I think she is in the film.
She is, absolutely.
She, now, I said in my review, there has not been a representation of teen normalcy like her since Molly Ringwald.
No, I agree.
And Molly Ringwald played her mother on Secret Life of American Teenager. Right. So they passed that baton, you know. She is the opposite, in a way, of Jennifer Lawrence, who off-screen is very real and makes a show of being very real off-screen. But on-screen, she's a glamorous movie star lady.
Well, post-Winter's Bone.
Post-Winter's Bone, yes. Shailene Woodley isn't that. Woodley is
every
every girl. Yeah. And I like that about her.
No, definitely.
And again, Laura Dern is really
terrific. Laura Dern is dynamite.
Laura Dern's got 5 good minutes in this movie, but boy, she makes them all
every
count.
She works it.
So I also saw The Sacrament, which is the new movie from Ty West, who made The House of the Devil and The Innkeepers. He participated in the ABCs of Death. And this is his new movie, which is not really a horror movie.
No.
It's about some guys from Vice magazine. And it's, every time I think about that, I love that idea. It's like, the guys from Vice magazine are going to go investigate a religious cult because we're badasses, and that's what we do
at
Vice magazine.
And also, it's a way to tell a movie in that sort of first-person camera style and have an excuse for it, you know?
And it's the Your Next Players.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody,
Swanberg's
that whole mumblecore, mumblegore crowd, who are now like they all make movies, they all write movies, they all act in movies, and they all do it with each other.
Is Amy Simons in this?
Yeah, she's the main. Woman.
She's the girl. Oh,
she's the,
okay, yeah.
So I'm really into this crew of people and the stuff they're doing. Because you can feel how comfortable they all are with each other and how sort of tight they are and how they get each other. And they want to be in each other's stuff because they believe in each other's work.
They finish each other's sandwiches.
Yes. Shut up. And so you just made me lose my whole train of thought. So Amy Simons is a junkie, rich girl trust fund junkie, who gets involved in a rehab that is actually a religious cult. And her brother, who is a Brooklyn-based fashion photographer and friendly with the people from Vice.
Aha, perfect.
It is perfect. It's so weird. Like, Vice signed off on this as a kind of like,
all right, you can kind of mock us a little bit.
Like, yeah, I mean, because cool they use the same kind of like on-screen, yes, you know.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the Vice, the font, you know.
If you've ever seen the Vice TV show on HBO, the news, the news show they do, it's similarly
it branded.
Looks, it looks the same. Yeah. And so they.
So she's in rehab and she's off in the middle of nowhere.
The cult takes her out of the country.
Yeah.
And then she writes her brother a letter after just being missing and says, oh, why don't you come visit us? Now, that's your first mistake. You say yes to that, and you're asking for trouble.
Well, at least you bring the Vice crew with you
because
you know something.
Because it's Vice magazine, if you've ever watched their show, their job is to go to the weird places that everyone else is too terrified to go
right.
to. Like the freaky, like, we're going to go hang out with drug lords.
Yeah.
And see if, and hope we don't get killed. Ta-da, like journalism. And so, so they do it, and then everything goes wrong. Every single possible thing goes wrong. And the cult is very, 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 very Jim Jones, People's Temple, Jonestown Massacre kind of stuff, with a little bit of the Heaven's Gate people thrown in there for good measure.
They're not all wearing matching sneakers, though.
They aren't. And there's some, you know, Source Family stuff. Except without the glamour, because those people were well-dressed. Holy crap.
From the 70s?
You ever see the Source Family documentary?
I think we've talked about it.
It will make you want to join the Source Family. And have sex with Father Yod of the Source Family, no matter what your sexual orientation
and make salad dressing.
Or gender. Yeah, you'll just be like, oh yeah, you.
I'm in.
Yeah, do me. I've never been into 55-year-old men before, but I'm rethinking this.
Okay, so if this isn't a horror movie, what is it?
It's a horrific movie.
Okay.
How's that?
Fair enough.
It's about paranoia and religious extremism and how the media participates in showcasing these people to a degree that amplifies their actual presence and importance in world events so bored people on the internet can be amused by them.
And it's good.
Yes.
Okay.
It is. Like I said, it's not a horror movie, but... And it's not a retelling of Jonestown.
Right.
But it uses the details of that event. And horror movie tricks, you know, tropes of horror films.
Okay.
To communicate a sense of dread. And also, like I say, to sort of, you know, comment on the idea of fringy stuff suddenly taking over our imaginations. Like the open carry people in Texas. Ugh. How many of those guys are there really?
100? Just how many are recovering?
100? Yeah. And it's all over the news.
Right.
How much of the population are these open carry lunatics who are carrying their big guns into Wendy's?
Right.
How many of them are there versus how many times do we hear about it in the course of a news day, while we're on Facebook, while we're on Twitter, people commenting about it on the news.
Right, but this is the trend that involves people carrying armed, you know, live weapons into public places.
So they are a tiny portion of the population.
Right.
They deserve as little attention as possible so that their cause
doesn't become
celebrated.
Right.
But we all know about them.
Hmm.
And so,
or that guy with the cattle in Nevada.
Yeah. And what happened when that nut job got a little press? All the other nut jobs went to his aid.
Yeah.
And turned it into a giant standoff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, oh, look, it's the dogs downstairs enjoying gay pride with her barking. Soon they'll begin howling and playing their own bagpipes, apparently. So, yeah, this is an interesting movie. I really enjoyed it. I think it's creepy. And it's strange, and again, I'm really into this crew of people who make these films.
Right.
They are connected to the people who made...
Your Next,
and also, no, I'm blanking, Ain't Them Bodies Saints.
Right, yeah. David Lowery, is he involved in this?
I don't know if he's involved in it, but the two of the people from Anthem Body Saints is in it.
Oh, okay.
What was the one we loved last year so much, the title?
Upstream Color?
Upstream Color. It's right. Like, those guys are sort of connected to these people.
Yeah, there's too, a lot of overlapping ovals on this Venn diagram of these guys, yeah.
It's on demand.
As you say, yeah,
you don't have to wait.
Small theatrical release, but it is available on demand, so you can stream it now. Several small movies in small release.
All of them gay.
Yes. Well, Obvious Child opened this weekend. We're going to talk about that next week because Dave hasn't seen it yet.
Yes.
But you can read my review of it at The Wrap. But yeah, there were a handful of gay films that are opening in L.A. and a few other cities this weekend. The first of which is an HBO documentary called The Case Against 8, which will be premiering on the network later this month. And it's a documentary specifically about the court challenge to Proposition 8 in California and the lawyers and the defendant couples, a male couple and a female couple who took the case all the way to the Supreme Court. I saw it at Sundance. It's incredibly moving and incredibly powerful, not just as sort of a story of injustice, but as kind of a Valentine to the Constitution. Like the idea that there is redress and there is a chance to for people to kind of take an unjust law to court and fight it and win, you know.
Yes.
The woman who wrote that, the New York Times reporter who wrote that book about the gay marriage fight in the U.S. Right. took a lot of flack because she really just focused on these people, which, and it's a big story, but it's only part of the story. This movie at least has the advantage in that it is just focused on this story and that's the only story it's telling. It doesn't pretend to be the entire history of the marriage equality battle in the U.S.
Right.
And so for its
this is the part of the show where I actually should have started talking about your family dictating to me.
True.
How long we've actually been a couple.
But anyway, so, you get to know the two couples involved. It's like, two gay guys, and then there's a lesbian couple in San Francisco who have children. And I just was so moved by this movie, and I really want people to see it. It's getting a small theatrical release this weekend. It will be airing on HBO before the end of the month, so people should look for it. Be on the lookout for it. Somebody asked us if speaking of HBO, somebody asked us if we wanted to talk a little about The Normal Heart.
I like it when Julia Roberts yells.
That's a plus. I think what works about The Normal Heart movie that they made is the Larry Kramer. Is the material. The play is so powerful that it overcomes the fact that it's being directed by Ryan Murphy, who more often than not, I think, kind of makes weird choices as far as, how he cuts certain things and casting and whatnot. But I think I found overall it was a powerful experience, and I think it's a good... If you are somebody who doesn't really know the history of how AIDS started in this country... it's a good place to start, and then afterwards there's a lot of documentaries you should watch, but, I think it's an okay kind of 101.
Yeah. I mean, I
remember at the very beginning you were immediately put off by the anachronisms in terms of just, like, the men's bodies in Fire Island.
80s cultural details, bodies, clothing, hair, the way people spoke to each other, I understand that they had to shorthand a lot of things to just move it along and sort of place it in a time and
cultural context.
Yeah, but I really get taken out of films when the period details are not real, when they are filtered through current sensibilities.
Right.
When the hair that we would look at in a real photograph and look at and say, oh, dude, that hair. Mm-hmm. No one has that hair.
Right.
They've all got variations on that hair, but that look acceptable for 2014.
Yeah, the retro version of that haircut that you would get now for a lot of money.
Yes.
And not the actual version of that haircut that was the rage in 1982 and that now has aged ridiculously.
Right.
And it's not like they don't have research materials for this.
Correct.
I mean, I was trying to explain to somebody. I said, all you have to do is watch any gay porn made that year, and you will see exactly
what
they looked like, what the bodies looked like, what the ideal was supposed to be that these dudes in Fire Island would be lounging around in their Speedos in. You know.
Yep.
Exactly.
So so that bothered me. But otherwise, you know, I thought it was, you know.
Yeah, I liked Mark Ruffalo.
Well acted and well written. I think Ryan Murphy is a really average filmmaker.
Yeah, but he cast it really well.
He cast it really well. I can't say, you know, it stuck with me for a long time.
It didn't, and I didn't cry.
But I think Julia Roberts was really terrific.
Yeah.
Especially, again, in her scene where she's yelling. Ruffalo gets several good moments.
Mm-hmm. I liked Matt Bomer.
And the guy.
Joe Mantello. The Taylor Kitsch.
The guy from Broadway who yells at.
Joe Mantello.
That's Joe Mantello.
Yeah.
He has a really great scene.
Mm-hmm.
So it fell into discrete chunks for me.
Yeah, I kind of agree. It's weird. I sort of wish I hadn't read anything about it beforehand, because one of the things that people were making a big to-do about was the fact that Matt Bomer had lost all this weight because his character, you know, contracts AIDS and you know. And I guess I was expecting a McConaughey level of...
skinniosity.
Yeah, and I think, and it's not that Bomer doesn't get skinny, it's that I think he starts from a point of already being kind of skinny, so it wasn't as...
He didn't have a whole lot to lose.
So it's not like seeing Tom Hanks turn into, like, sunken-eyed, long-haired guy. Right. Like, it's like, oh, okay, so you're thinner?
You were already thin, trim, and lean, and now you're...
Yeah.
Like a sticky person.
Yeah. So if I hadn't read about so much about that beforehand, that wouldn't have been as big a deal.
Right.
But overall, I'd say it's fine. It's not great, but it's fine. And I, you know, as always, will tell people, go watch How to Survive a Plague when you get done with this, you know. Watch the real Larry Kramer scream at people. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah, he will too, boy.
Yeah. Before I go on, who else is this show brought to you by, Dave?
Some book.
Some book, like some pig.
In Charles
Webb. It is some book.
That is right. This is, by the way, according to Tom DiCillo.
Uh-huh.
Is that his name? How do you say his name?
Tom DiCillo, the guy who made Living in Oblivion.
Director of Living in Oblivion. The film everyone knows and loves.
I love Steve Buscemi and
Living in Oblivion, Johnny Suede, Delirious, When You're Strange. He says, this is an amazingly well-researched and accurate chronicle of independent filmmaking.
Well, all right.
I learned so much, things I wish I'd known when I was in the middle of it all myself.
Ha-ha!
It's hard sometimes to make filmmaking advice flow with dramatic interest, but author Reed Martin keeps it clear, eloquent, and fresh. I would definitely suggest, title of book, The Real Truth. That's who we're talking about right now.
Everything you didn't know you need to know about making an independent film.
He would recommend it, Tom DiCillo would, to aspiring filmmakers.
Well, all right.
It would make a great textbook.
Well.
He says, I am personally looking forward to the next volume, especially now.
And if you've seen Living in Oblivion, you know that, like, that is the movie about all the pitfalls of making an independent movie. So these are high words of praise indeed.
You know who else is kissing Reed Martin's ass?
Do tell.
Miguel Arteta.
Whoa.
Yeah. Director of The Good Girl.
Yeah.
Which is such a good movie.
And one of my favorite films, Chuck and Buck.
One of your favorite films, Chuck and Buck. Cedar Rapids, he made.
Yes, also good.
But boy, The Good Girl. It's one of those great Jennifer Aniston scowly performances. It's like the only time I like her in movies, when she's being just a disgruntled, unhappy person.
I like Friends with Money better, but Good Girl is good.
Friends with Money is also really good, and good, and a good Aniston performance.
Yeah.
Miguel Arteta says, Reed Martin's The Real Truth. Not only a terrific guide for aspiring filmmakers and a modern textbook, there's that word again.
Mm-hmm.
For film school students everywhere, the advice and anecdotes and the chapters covering production, marketing, distribution, online exhibition, they are useful for working filmmakers as well.
Alrighty. So yeah, just because you made a movie doesn't mean you're so cool that you can't learn something from Reed Martin.
Right. You don't know everything.
You don't. No.
Where's Dave Kittredge? We kicked him out too soon. He made a movie.
You know what? Dave Kittredge is the guy who I mentioned, who at the party a couple weeks ago told the guy, the would-be screenwriter, dude, you need to pick up The Real Truth.
Oh, did he actually say that?
He said that, yes.
So you read Martin?
Word is out.
Your ad's working.
Yes.
And our horrible delivery of your ads is working. It's
monumentally effective, despite all odds.
And we still have, We still have copies to give away. We actually have more than one copy now.
Yes.
To give away.
Reed was nice enough to pony up a couple of extras.
We have a couple of entries.
But we want more.
One of them's okay. One of them sucks. I'm sorry, dude.
You know who you are.
You wrote 53 words, first of all. You're not even good at counting.
How are you going to make a movie?
How are you going to make a movie? Count. Yeah, you can't even count. But we want more. We want more than like a couple of you. So keep writing your 50 words or less entries on why you want to get a copy of The Real Truth. And preference will be given to people who've been paying attention to these ads and who can
cite specific things that they want to learn.
Regurgitate things that I have told you about this book.
So send those entries to Linoleum Podcast.
If you're not listening to me, why are you even listening to this podcast?
To hear me.
That ain't right. That is not true either. You know that. Come on. Let's be honest.
They're here for the interplay.
Let's be honest.
They're here for the repartee.
I think we've had this discussion before on who is number one, and I think we all know.
Number one is the guy who can pull the plug out of your microphone.
You don't.
And render you silent.
No, you don't
That's who number one is.
You don't have that kind of power.
That's who number one. Over me. I got my finger on the button.
Do you have another movie that we need to talk about?
But anyway, send your essays to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. 50 words or less, folks, and we will consider the entries and pick out winners, and you will get a free copy of the book and even an extra goodie from Mr. Martin, who has passed those along. Also opening this week in limited release is a film called Test.
Of the D'Urbervilles.
Yes. No. It's called T.E.S.T., directed by Chris Mason Johnson. He had a film a few years ago called The New 20 that some folks might have seen. Played a lot of gay festivals and had a small
release. Some folks find obscene?
Might have seen.
Oh, you got to speak more clearly.
Oh, excuse me. This one is a period piece set in 1985 in San Francisco. It's about a young dancer who is part of a modern dance troupe. And
I'm a dancer.
That's right. And he's not doing it at the Cheetah. He's a legitimate dancer.
I'm a dancer.
And it's 1985. The HIV test has just become available.
So. Wait, case against eight. Normal heart. Test.
I got one more gay one after this.
Gay. AIDS.
Yes, my other one is not AIDS-y, but it is gay-y.
All right.
So basically, you know, and this isn't an AIDS movie in the traditional sense, like Normal Heart or Longtime Companion, where it's in the foreground and people are protesting and talking about it, figuring out what to do.
Right.
It's a thing that exists, and it's a thing that is happening in people's lives while they are living their lives, while they are trying to get ahead at work, while they are trying to fall in love, while they are excited about living in a new city on their own, you know.
Yeah.
And there's AIDS. And
then there's AIDS.
And then there's AIDS. And so, you know, this movie I thought did a really good job of kind of, you know, you look at a lot of historical films and you think that the historical thing is first and foremost in everybody's mind, you know. But like, you know, when World War II was happening, if you were on the home front, you know, yes, you were concerned about your, you know, loved ones who were fighting overseas and you were maybe trying to raise money for bonds or whatever. But, you know, you were putting food on the table three times a day and you were going to work and you were doing whatever. And so what's cool about Test is that it, you know, it's about this guy and his life as a dancer, but it's also about the larger context of what's going on among gay people in San Francisco in 1985. And it's really beautifully done. And there's a lot of really great dance sequences in it.
What cities is this playing in right now?
I think it opened this weekend in L.A. and New York and San Francisco.
All right.
But it's going to be getting around, and it's being distributed by Wolf, and so they'll obviously be putting it out on video later this year.
Right.
But it's a lovely movie. I very highly recommend it.
I'll be the judge of that.
The last of the small release gay movies this weekend is Gore Vidal.
It's really good that they put them all out at the same time.
I know, and on Pride weekend too. When the gays don't have anything else to do.
It's Los Angeles' Pride weekend.
I know, but still.
They're
opening in Los Angeles when, like, everybody's, you know, getting drunk in a tent somewhere.
Party!
And watching, you know, Azalea Banks. The other one is Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia, which is a great documentary about Vidal. They started shooting it while he was still alive and got some of the last interviews he ever gave in the film.
Where do I see this? Where's this playing?
It's at the New Art this week, and hopefully, it'll pop up elsewhere later. We screened it at Outfest last year, got a standing ovation.
Is it going to be on HBO in 3 weeks?
I don't know. but it's an amazing movie because Vidal just lived such an interesting life as an author, as a sort of public activist, as he was in an era where we sort of had people who were famous for being smart and articulate.
Yeah.
And, you know, who would go on TV and be smart and articulate and argue with other people who were smart and articulate. And in the case of Gore Vidal, you know, get threatened of, you know, like, what's the thing that William Buckley famously said to him? Like, I'll punch you, you queer, or something.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Which is in the movie.
and Gore Vidal's like,
yeah, bring it.
So would.
Anyway, it's a dynamite documentary. Really kind of, if you don't know anything about Vidal, or if you do, and maybe you don't know everything, it's very... you'll learn a lot, and he just lived in such an interesting period in terms of the changes that he saw in society and in civil rights and stuff over the course of his lifetime, and what he had to say about it is just endlessly fascinating, I think. So people should check it out.
All right, I got a letter.
Oh, yeah. The second that this flew out of your mouth, I knew we were going to get a letter, and we did.
Alonzo and Dave especially. So, this is a letter that's going to shower me with praise.
Yeah, read on.
Dave especially.
Why don't you? This should be Dave only, because I'm innocent.
All right, before I read this letter, I want you to know that it has a happy ending, because we fixed it. I've had a very nice dialogue with the writer of this letter.
A correspondence.
Yeah. And I'm... okay, well, I'm going to read the letter and then I'm going to explain everything. Okay. Alonzo and Dave especially. I've considered you guys relatively reliable when it comes to at least pointing out transphobia where others have overlooked it. But what Dave said about us appalled me. Okay, now... I need to go back and explain what happened. This is not part of the letter.
Last week in our DVD recommendations,
Sleepaway Camp is coming out on Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. Y'all listen to this show long enough, you know I love Sleepaway Camp. I especially love Sleepaway Camp for one very specific reason. The killer, shockingly, surprisingly, because of the way the film is constructed.
We have to spoil the ending now.
We do have to spoil the ending.
This movie's like 30
now.
Years old, so deal
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, this is a 30-year-old movie, so if you don't know the ending, then too bad. The killer turns out to be a girl who is a boy. The film never calls
the character
Angela trans, because the film is hiding that fact from you.
Yeah, the character is presented as female throughout until the shocking ending, and it turns out this character has a penis.
Yeah.
I have always found it icky and exploitive.
I
am blameless in this.
All right, just shut up. Now, in my discussion of Sleepaway Camp last week, I said, go Angela, kill them all. You powerful trans killer lady. I also said, I'm surprised trans people aren't murdering people all the time, given the way they are treated by society. Mm. In my head, that was a compliment. But we're going to get to the reasons why.
You're thinking you go. I knew where you were coming from on this. But.
Yes. All right. So what Dave said about us appalled me. And then, parenthetically, I'll lay off Dave's questionable critical opinion of the film here, though that implicitly ties into what I have to say. I realize he meant no harm, but saying he's surprised we transgender people don't go around killing people, presumably merely because we're oppressed, is terrible. It further serves to other us, that's like capital O, other us, and pathologize us. We're just normal people like y'all. Your sexuality was once as oppressed as ours. Did you appreciate it when killers in the past were sexually othered in such a way, as they still are for us now, and that you have unwittingly perpetuated? When Fox News even recently said Elliot Rodger was suppressing homosexuality. I realize you want to do better, so please don't consider this call out an insult. I just hope you'll be more careful in your choice of words in the future. Okay, now that's from Molly, who is a listener, and a listener that we totally appreciate. Now, I am now going to read my response. This was my response to Molly. But I'm not going to read the back and forth because that was, you know, it turned out nicely. And there's no, I don't want to spend a million years like doing this, but here's what I wrote. I would like to apologize for my idiotic off-the-cuff joke. And the reason I made this joke, actually, I'm not going to read my response. I'm going to explain it. And I believe it is right for me to apologize for the joke because the joke is predicated on something that I have never articulated on the show. All I have ever done on the show is say, go Sleepaway Camp, go Angela the Killer. You know, like that's the way I've presented this. And I did that without differentiating my love of exploitation film. And this is an exploitation film. From my ideas about real life. Now, I grew up in the 80s, and I have and everyone who listens to the show knows this more or less too, I have a background in the hardcore scene, punk rock. Now, that world employed a lot of visual violence, auditory violence,
hyperbole.
Violent ideas and hyperbole. It was part of the subculture. That imagery was always a part of the subculture. At the time, I was a big fan of Richard Kern. Some of you guys may know who this was, but he was an underground filmmaker. In the 80s, he made a movie with Lydia Lunch called Fingered, which really angered a lot of people. He made one that I was an especially big fan of called You Killed Me First. It's a short film. It's about a teenage girl who has dinner with her family, and they are so horrible that she murders all of them. Boom, that's the end of the movie. Later, when I came out as gay after college, I was really into the comic book Hothead Paisan, and some of you may know what that is. I think that the subtitle for Hothead Paisan was always Homicidal Lesbian Terrorist.
I believe so.
Wasn't that the name?
I think so.
And Hothead Paisan was a lesbian comic book about a murderous, vengeance-obsessed lesbian who runs around, like, chopping guys' dicks off.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
That was the punchline.
That was always the punchline of a joke. Like, I kill you now with an axe. Like, and there goes your penis. Boom. And I always thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
I liked Hothead Paisan. So, I got the joke.
Now, Sleepaway Camp, I realize, is a problematic movie.
It's not being made by Richard Kern.
It is not being made by Richard Kern. And it is the makers were not making a trans teen girl gets revenge movie.
No.
They were making a movie about a homicidal lunatic who happens to be trans.
And they were making a slasher movie, and they wanted a shocking revelation that nobody had done before.
Yeah. And so they were, as Molly says, they were othering her.
Yeah.
And that's true. To enjoy this movie, you have to view it through the filter of kind of that era's sort of punk rock aesthetic,
or even just the way that people watch Basic Instinct and cheer on, you know, the homicide. Anyway, go. This is your thing.
I've always sided with the killer. Always, Halloween, Friday the 13th, Psycho. I always side with the killer. The killer is the fun person in the movie. The killer is the one doing things in the movie. The victims are just dying and screaming and having sex or whatever, being in some way a little bit bad to, you know, earn, in quotes, their death. The cool person in these movies is always the killer. So for me, watching Sleepaway Camp, I'm always, A, cheering on the deaths, And B, at the end of Sleepaway Camp, when I realized that it's that she's been pushed to this by the world and by the bullying, absolute bullying treatment that she has received at the hands of these horrible kids that she's at camp with. Not only did I love the ending as that shock, but I love the idea that she is the victor. And so, you know, to watch it through that filter is the way that you can appreciate it and not be, I guess, well, it's a way to intentionally ignore what are probably the intent of the filmmaker. I did that with Cruising. I did that with Basic Instinct, like you said. Mm-hmm. I didn't see these films as exploitive. I mean, and they both are. And I do understand that there's that element of exploitation. But what I always thought of during those, I mean, I was around when those movies were released, when mm-hmm. Cruising and Basic Instinct were released, and I remember the protests.
Yeah.
But each time I saw a film like that, I thought, no, this just makes queer people look powerful and dangerous. And if you do anything, cross us, and we're going to come after you.
Okay, but why do you not think that way about Windows?
Windows is just a terrible film.
I see.
Windows is just a terrible film. And Windows isn't a slasher film in the way that these other movies are.
It's a victimization movie.
It's a rape movie.
Yeah.
And you become complicit in this rape, you know. A murder in a movie, in a horror film, is not the same thing as a rape in a thriller or a drama, you know. You don't cheer on the serial rapist.
Right, it's a different transaction. But you do cheer on the serial
killer, you know. And Windows is a rape movie.
No, Windows is vile. I'm just trying to figure out where the line is.
But again, like I said earlier in the other podcast, Windows must be seen because it is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, you just know your history and see Windows. Yeah. Like, you'll get...
Watching Staircase. It's despicable, but you need to know that it existed, you know.
So, I have a soft spot for these kind of exploitation films. I have a soft spot for any movie where the queer character is the murderer, is the bad person. Because in my way of looking at this, it's a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a way to get straight people to straighten up and fly right.
Keep straight people scared of us. I mean, that's always been my motto. Stay scared of us. And so...
Happy Pride, everyone.
We're not nice like you. Be scared of us. So, like, that's... Seriously, that's just how I've always walked through life that way. You know, of course, in film history, there is this, you know, ugly, ugly tradition of silence about gay people.
Right.
Lesbians, bisexuals, transgender folks, you know, everybody. And then when there wasn't silence, there was... You're homicidal, you're a threat, you're a predator, you're a murderer, you're a maniac.
Right.
Or worse, you dared to be in love and you must be killed at the end of the film.
Right.
Or commit suicide.
Or kill yourself.
Or kill yourself. That's bad. But when we get to be bad in movies, even those vintage bad old days kind of movies, mm-hmm. there's just something about it that really makes me think, yeah, that's right. Don't mess with us. Do not. You'll get yours if you do.
I see where you're coming from. I don't completely agree with you. But I like the idea of taking what is perceived as a negative image and finding a way to make it empowering. I mean, like, that's one of the things that I love about William Fichtner in that terrible movie, What's the Worst That Could Happen, is that he's playing such the sissy, dandy character, which for decades would have been the butt of the jokes. But in that movie...
He was the guy who knew everything.
He's the guy in charge. Yeah. Everybody's afraid of him because he's the smartest and the most sharp cop who's going to, like... who's going to unravel this entire, like, you know, caper that's going on.
And I really like that. I like it even better when you add that layer of murder to it.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Now, outside of my appreciation for that kind of film, and this is what I said to Molly, who wrote the letter, you know, I want to make it unequivocally clear. I reject the idea, obviously, that LGBT people are pathological or predisposed to violence or murder in real life. When I said what I said, I was being thoughtless and goofy, and that's a problem that I have all the time. My mouth opens, things come out,
but then I
think, oh, should I have said that?
But I think,
or you more often you come to me and said, should you have said that?
I think you guys had a very constructive dialogue about this. There have been other recent cases about use of language, whatnot, well, yeah, that I think has been a lot.
Right now is the moment,
yeah,
in social history in this country where the dialogue about trans issues is happening. It's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Cover of Time magazine,
and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And I want people to, you know, to think about where they're coming from with their own. Everybody needs to think about what they think about this stuff.
Sure.
Because the most important thing you need to do, especially if you're you and me,
mm-hmm,
all right, because you and me, for example, specifically Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, we are white, cisgendered, gay males.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes privilege automatic. You know, the gay thing is a recent, you know,
phenomenon,
you know, where suddenly that's a little less reviled as it was in the past.
Right.
You know, and so automatically by being born into a white body, by being born into a male body that identifies as traditionally male, you know, and doesn't feel any sort of, you know, oh, wait, I'm something else, yeah, than that. You are living within a system that bestows upon you, without you earning anything, a lot of privileges. And so, so you especially, as that guy, you, me, we have to be thoughtful about that kind of thing and listen. Yeah. Instead of yakking all the time.
Right.
Now, because this is a podcast, we are yakking all the time.
That's our job.
But I, you know,
we appreciate the feedback.
Thank you for writing, Molly. And I'm glad that, and again, we've had the further email contact about, yeah, this. And it's, everything's good. I have always thought of us, you know, the L, the B, the G, and the T. I've always thought of us as being sort of in the same gang. But there are differences that we have to, you know, listen to.
Yeah, and I think the rising tide hasn't risen all boats equally.
No.
You know.
No.
I think that, yeah, and I mean, Jenny Olsen pointed out, I think, in that documentary Fabulous we're both in, that the trans movement is always about, you know, 10 or 20 years behind the sort of mainstream gay lesbian movement
in terms of being listened to
and in the culture, you know,
and
in terms
day-to-day
of
day-to-day life of people, because I, yeah, mean, having, when we were in Atlanta,
mm-hmm,
a woman was assaulted on the MARTA train while, mm, we were there,
right,
and stripped like naked, mm, and no one did anything.
Yeah.
So there's actual like violence inflicted,
yeah,
on trans people that doesn't happen so much.
No, and we can't get ENDA passed, and I'm on mailing lists for certain crazy right wing organizations just to see what they're getting out there.
Right.
And I mean, the stuff that the panic emails they send out about what happens if trans people are given, you know, any kind of federal recognition, it's like, you know, oh, you're, you know, cross dressing kindergarten teachers, blah, right, you know, using the bathroom of the blah. It's just, right, ridiculous stuff. So yeah, you know, I'm glad we were called out on it. You were called out on it, and you will try to do better in the future.
I I still love Sleepaway Camp.
And that's fine. No one's going to take that away from you. By the way, what's your DVD pick this week?
I don't know. What is my... Oh, The Thin Man.
Yes.
We saw it last night
mm-hmm.
for my 50th birthday.
Yes.
I had never seen The Thin Man mm-hmm. before. I had been waiting. You move to Los Angeles, you get to see things on screens. It's not an especially cinematic kind of film. It's not like you need to see it on a screen. But when you have the opportunity...
Why not?
to go and see an old 35mm print of The Thin Man with William Powell and Myrna Loy and their drunkenness, you should do that. If it happens to coincide with your 50th birthday...
So much the better.
What a treat for you. It's on DVD. You can see a nice clean version of it on DVD. We saw a print that had a few pops and skips, but I'm in pretty good shape. I'm really into that, too.
Yeah, I know. It's like vinyl.
Yeah.
My DVD pick this week is Alan Partridge, a movie we talked about when it had its brief theatrical release on the show. It's now on DVD, starring Steve Coogan as a character he's been playing for a long time, an unctuous morning radio DJ in Norwich, England, who gets involved in a hostage crisis and, as usual, tries to manipulate the situation to help his own career. It's very funny. Are there more letters?
There's a bunch more, but... But that was a long one, so...
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll pick up next week.
But plus, Molly gave a top 10, but I'm going to hang off on that.
Okay.
Well, because Molly, your top 10 has to go into the top 10 queue.
And there's you don't get to skip ahead.
There's a queue, yeah.
Are you going to do any top 10s this week?
No. How long have we been going on for? 90 minutes? Longer than 90 minutes? Yeah, we're done.
Okay, fine. We are still accepting...
We're gonna wear out our welcome.
We are still accepting essays in the contest to win a free copy of The Real Truth, Everything You Didn't Know You Need to Know by Making an Independent Film by Reed Martin. So 50 words or less, email them to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Also over at that address, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, you can buy things from us.
Yeah, you can do
it. You can PayPal us $1.99 each to receive our extra episodes. Our Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife episodes that are devoted to single films.
Yes.
We've done White Christmas, we have done The Apple, we've done Clue, and we've done Two for the Road, and those are available for $1.99 each.
You can
PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Give us the email address where you want those sent. You can also prepay for a Linoleum Knife t-shirt. We're about to order a brand new set of those. And you can PayPal us $20. Forget that. $20. To linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
We're cute and gimmicky about the...
This is pointless. $20 to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. These are Hanes Beefy Tees, 100% cotton. So let us know what size you want and let us know where they should be mailed. And once we order them, you will get yours first. And then,
this is a pre-order you're going to wait.
Right.
And you're going to wait a little bit.
Yes. You can also visit linoleum-knife.com.
Think of it as your contribution to the summer of 2014, which has been officially themed by the city of Los Angeles as the summer where you give us your money.
Ah, yes, it's true.
The summer where you give Dave and Alonzo your money.
Yes.
It was a proclamation. The mayor actually mm-hmm. made a proclamation.
And it's such a catchy name, too.
This is the summer of when you give Dave and Alonzo your money.
Yes. So
each word capitalized is like a title.
So we're all very excited about that summer happening.
The summer of when you give Dave
We hope you'll do money. That. In the meantime, check out our friends elsewhere in the podcast universe. Go to ChristyLemire.com. If you're a SiriusXM subscriber, listen to the Frank DeCaro Show and Derek and Romaine. We will not be on this week. Usually we're on the second Friday of the month, but they are on vacation or something. So you will not hear our dulcet tones again until July. Check out... Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, and he's got an episode with our good friend Tom Ford. Not that Tom Ford, but our friend Tom Ford, who is a very talented visual effects guy. And he...
is that what he does?
Yeah. And
I thought he just complained a lot about stuff.
Well, you know, that's...
I thought that was what his job was.
No, he does that for free. Anyway, but he's currently living in Budapest working on the new Paul Feig movie, so they have an interesting conversation about life in Hungary and all kinds of other stuff. Check out the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt Achety and Gray Drake. Fat Guys of the Movies, The Schmoes Know, The Criterion Cast, B Movies Podcast with Whitney and Bibbs, Films Spotting SVU, Podcrash, The Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, and The Lunch. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes, and if you want to leave us a review there, that would be great. You would be just like our good friends, WeHo SoCal Guy, CX Chuck, and WhatHo Tom Ford, who all left us reviews. I'm calling out people who left us reviews on iTunes, which we appreciate. They are good reviews.
Okay, good.
You
get to live.
You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. You can like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast, where people like Vince and James have left us some interesting...
Vince who? James what?
It's a, go to our Facebook page to find out.
All right.
You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast.
Look at the end of that old kid show, Romper Room,
where yes, she would look at the magic mirror yes.
And tell you the names of children, random children's names mm-hmm, that
but these
real.
Are these are actual real names.
These are actual
on,
real names.
On Twitter, Grant mm-hmm. and Sean and Bjorn and Blamanda have left us.
Blamanda. I like that name.
I do too. Have left us feedback on our Twitter page. So
how
thank you so much
today,
for
Amanda?
That.
Blah. My name is Blamanda.
You can also check into the show at tvtag.com. And once again, our email address, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us any questions, comments, complaints about Dave White.
No.
Your top 10 list.
I'm so nice.
Your bottom 10 list. And, of course, your essays on why you deserve a copy of The Real Truth, Everything You Need to Know About Making Independent... Everything You Know You Didn't Know You Need to Know About Making Independent Film by Reed Martin.
No complaints unless I've done something... Okay, I did something wrong and it was legitimately complained about.
Well, there you go.
So I just... No more complaints.
If you keep messing up, you're going to get complaints, and that's just how the world works.
I'm not going to keep messing up because I am very close to human perfection.
Uh-huh. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.